Hi, this is Carrie Brownstein.
This is DJ Premier.
This is Darren Aronofsky.
You got the RZA right here.
Rose McGowan.
Right here.
Hey. Aisha Tyler.
A Tribe Called Quest.
Fred Armisen.
Fritz Paul.
Javier Munoz. Seth Meyers.
Frankie Cosmos.
Flying Lotus.
Hi, we're Haim. And you're listening to the Talk House Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Talk House Podcast. I'm Josh Modell. Today we've got an unlikely pairing between two performers who share a home state, but it would seem at first glance not too much else. Though that's just first glance. Britt Daniel of Spoon and Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top. Now, the genesis of this conversation was actually a conversation that Britt Daniel made around the time the band announced its new album, Lucifer on the Sofa. About the song The Hardest Cut, he simply said that he'd been listening to a lot of ZZ Top in the years leading up to the album's recording. And while the song is certainly no tribute to ZZ Top, you can hear the snarl and bite coming through in its tones and its lyrics. Check out a little bit of The Hardest Cut.
You took off in the dead of night, but before you did, got your hair combed right, yeah. The neighborhood watch those a score, and they're knocking at your door, let them knock some more.
That's a great song from a great new album, and it's album number 10 for Spoon, who have had an incredibly strong run over the past almost three decades. Lucifer on the Sofa is out this week, and it stands among their best, catchy, considered, and a bit more raw than their other recent records. Maybe that's because they recorded it back in Britt's home state, which of course is where the legendary ZZ Top was born as well. Billy Gibbons formed the band with Dusty Hill and Frank Beard way back in 1969, and the original trio rocked consistently for five decades until Hill's death in 2021. The blues-inspired rock band gained traction in the 70s with songs like LaGrange and Tush, then took off in the 80s as they became superstars of the early MTV era with Sharp Dressed Man and Legs. They were shoo-ins for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, of course, and not even Hill's death could stop them. His guitar tech and friend Elwood Francis stepped in, and ZZ Top will play shows with Cheap Trick this April. All the dates, naturally, are at ZZTop.com. Daniel and Gibbons talk a lot about what they have in common, which is the state of Texas, and specifically its myriad Mexican restaurants. Daniel asks about the legendary photo inside ZZ Top's classic 1973 album Tres Hombres, and Gibbons gets a chance to talk about some of his contemporaries and friends, including Rocky Erickson of the 13th Floor Elevators and Bo Diddley, with whom he collaborated on a guitar design, among other things. Enjoy.
Good to meet you, Billy.
Same on this side. We've been all over the place in the last 6 weeks, and we're finally catching up. The band is taking a little 60-day hiatus before we get back to it. The good news, we lit the fuse back in July and steady worked without a single cancellation. Every night was sold out. Just an amazing stroke of good fortune on that note.
Amazing.
I think the next outing includes Cheap Trick wants to open some dates with us up in Canada. And as you know, the gates open and the gates close and the gates open.
Right. Yeah. Well, and we almost got a chance to play together, but that New Year's Eve show got canceled.
Yeah. I was really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
My goodness.
So many people were coming down with COVID at that moment. We didn't have a show, you know, but the Jungle Show gigs went all right. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
I still haven't gotten to see that.
The Jungle Show. What an interesting outing. Getting to see my old pals, Jimmy Vaughn, Mike Flanagan, Sue Foley. She's tearing the sounds off of her guitar. And Chris Layton on drums. It's a good gathering.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you were born in Houston, right?
Yeah.
And you live there now?
I keep a spot there. Somebody asked me recently, where do you hang your hat? And I said, it keeps changing towns. It's called a rolling tour bus.
Well, that's cool.
But we still got the crib out in Los Angeles, still got the key to the house in Las Vegas. And with this latest twist, we actually landed a place in Nashville, Tennessee. Interesting community to say. Place is blowing up.
Did you ever live in Austin?
Yeah, for a brief time, on and off, starting in the mid-70s. I was drawn to Austin. The Fabulous Thunderbirds had just put their outfit together, and they were playing on Monday nights at a rather famous place called the Rome Inn, which unfortunately I was informed this morning burned to the ground last night, which is a big...
Oh, that's where Texas French Bread? That became Texas French Bread?
Yes, Texas French Bread.
Oh, I didn't know that used to be a venue.
Yeah, back in the 70s, all through the 80s. What an interesting place. A lot of the local Austinites are scratching their head going, gee whiz, that was so many fond memories of the place. Stevie Ray got married in the upstairs.
Oh, wow.
In fact, I wrote a song called Low Down in the Streets, which chronicled the scene that unfolded on these fateful Monday nights when the T-Birds were holding court.
I got to Austin in 89, but I have no idea. I mean, what was Austin like in the 70s?
Well, Austin, being the capital of Texas, it drew students, lawyers, cowboys, vagrants, you name it. Everybody was there. And it seems like the 70s allowed this explosive collision of all these disparate entities. These were some great times. In fact, there's a really great book called The Unexpected Rise of Redneck Rock. And you had cowboys on one side of the room looking at the hippies on the other side of the room, and they were kind of wondering what's next. But it made right. made for an interesting, I use that word, collision.
Even when I got there, it still kind of felt like a college town, and now it sure does not. It's not a college town. It's an industry.
Yeah, I believe when Dell Computers brought the Dellionaires into the fray, it seemed like the explosive nature of expansion took over. There was a time when the state capitol was unencumbered visually. There was nothing to block the view from any direction. And now you're lucky to see it from downtown.
Yeah, you can see it up Congress, but that's about it.
Yeah. Surrounded by skyscrapers now. I like to refer it as the inside of the donut. There's that part that doesn't seem to want to change much, which is a great thing. It's still a great community.
Right.
And to stand by and watch week to week the flux of what you used to think you knew gets overtaken by road construction making a new avenue. And all of a sudden you find yourself in the small town of Austin. You're lost.
There's parts of Austin, especially downtown, that just... if you dropped me there, I just would not know where I was.
Yeah, it's really changed a lot. I was talking with Jimmy Vaughn, and he said, well, thank goodness, he said, my lovely sweetheart, Robin, she volunteered to squire me about the town. He said, I came in on my own, and what used to be I could do it blindfolded, he said, I got lost within 3 minutes.
I grew up in Temple, Texas, and, you know, it was a small town with a small town radio station, and at the end of my time in Temple, we started getting a station from Austin, but mostly I was cut off from that. I was, you know, taking my cues from, I would wait for a show called 120 Minutes on MTV on Sunday nights that played alternative music. And I would hear about, you know, British music from these British music magazines I could get at the bookstore in the mall. But when I started making music, you know, in retrospect, I don't think it was really about Texas music because there weren't gigs being played in Temple, and I was cut off from all. It was just, I took my cues from elsewhere. I don't feel like I got influenced by Texas till later on. But I get the sensation that Texas always played a big part in your musical education.
Yeah, right. Temple, Texas, it reminds me of so many of the outlying communities that are basically kind of in the outlands. And it's remarkable that MTV came along to... It kind of lifted the lid on so much stuff. I'm sure right. You can relate. With your musical background in mind, there's no question that MTV played quite a big part of, gosh, one's musical backgrounding. And I suppose that's fair to say it was the real awakening globally for so many spots that previously had just been a kind of a closed society, not really having the luxury of any kind of global impact. But that's in the rearview mirror, but we live in this new global community where seemingly everything is within one's reach today.
It's different.
Yeah, definitely. Just reach in your pocket, tap on a few numbers, and you're anywhere you want to be. My good friend Van Wilkes, who's been a longtime resident of Austin, and he came from Brownwood, Texas. And as you enter Brownwood, you have to pass through another small community called Early Texas, and it says there's a sign on the bridge as you approach Brownwood. It says entering Brownwood, leaving early.
Classic.
And I think a lot of small town folks were ready to leave early.
Yeah. So I do want to ask you about whose idea was it to put that insane photo of the Mexican meal in the gatefold of Tres Hombres?
There was a mystery member of ZZ Top in the form of the great art renderings from the late Bill Narum. And we had wrapped up the recordings for Tres Hombres in 1973. And it was kind of a great awakening for the band. It contained one of our favorite songs, which is still played today, LaGrange.
Right.
It was the first top 10 chart maker for the band. And Mr. Narum said, look, he said, I've got the front cover. I've got the back. He said, the record label is asking to do a fold out, a gatefold offering.
Even though it's a single record, they just wanted that.
Yeah, he said, got any ideas? And we were actually hanging out at the great Mexican restaurant down in Houston, Leo's Mexican restaurant, and tiptoed into the kitchen. And I said, Leo, I said, can you make a big larrapin spread of just about anything and everything? And he grinned. And next thing you know, it was laid out on the table. And it was actually so much. We had it packed up for takeaway. And went down the street to visit our photography buddy, Mr. Galen Scott. And Galen was rubbing his hands together. He said, gee whiz. He said, let's get this photograph session over quickly. He said, it's still warm enough and I'm hungry.
So it sounds like it was your idea.
Yeah, we put it together in about, I don't know, it came together rather quickly. And if you'll notice, there's some really interesting elements that we were able to squeeze into the photo frame. In the background is a radio with the dial lit up, and it was, of course, tuned into the far right end of the AM dial to pick up XERF, the Great Border Blaster radio station. There's a beer bottle from the old Howard Hughes days, Southern Select Beer. And behind the Mexican food was a calendar showcasing the great female Mexican revolutionary, La Adelita. So you get all these elements crammed into the frame.
It's such a great image.
Yeah.
I just love it. I take it Leo's doesn't exist anymore?
Yeah. The only thing left is the neon sign, and our good friend Mr. Jim Jard rescued it from the graveyard, and he actually had it restored, and he's got a rather impressive warehouse full of his hot rod cars and all kinds of Texas memorabilia, but it really comes to life when he ignites the neon sign, Leo's Mexican Restaurant.
Right.
Which also brings up, I was having an exchange with Jim Jard, and was in regard to that neon sign. I said, Jim, I said, next time we come through, I said, you know, you've got to light up the Leo sign. He goes, well, I got another one for you. He said, I was able to rescue another famous landmark from days gone by, another Mexican restaurant long gone, which was Felix Mexican Restaurant. They were famous for that crazy, that cheese dip. They had the Felix queso. It was a vein clogger.
Yeah, I do remember that one. So, but that doesn't exist anymore either. Is that right?
Yeah, unfortunately, they folded their tent.
So where do you like to get Mexican food in Houston then?
Oh, there's a very interesting spot run by Levi Good. And now Levi Good got his foot in the restaurant game thanks to his dad, Jim Good, who started with Good and Company Barbecue. And he handed the torch to his son, Levi. And then that became Barbecue Number Two. And then it was Good and Company Seafood. And most recently, there's now a Good and Company Tex-Mex Kitchen, and it is stunning, absolutely delightful.
Oh, I got to check that. I usually go to Ninfa's on Navigation or Armando's. You ever go to those?
Oh, man. Now, you're making me hungry. great spots there.
Hey, this is Josh Modell, host of the Talkhouse podcast.
We love it when musicians come on the show and talk about process, and often they'll get into the nuts and bolts of being a working artist, which can sometimes be fun and sometimes feel more like a business. Well, this episode of TalkHouse is brought to you by DistroKid, which is an amazing service for musicians looking to get their songs out into the world in an incredibly smart and cost-effective way. For the past decade plus, DistroKid has made it easy to get your music on all the streaming services, including Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Instagram, and more. You keep 100% of your earnings minus a flat yearly fee, which is a better deal than you'll find anywhere else. More than a million artists use DistroKid, and the latest version of their app is better than ever. It includes features that make it easy to see your account details, including the money you've earned, as well as to seamlessly edit things like lyrics and metadata across platforms. There's even a feature called Instant Share, which allows you to easily share files with your bandmates, booking agent, playlist curators, and more. Distro Lock allows you to protect your songs. DistroKid users get a YouTube official artist channel, too. The list goes on. The DistroKid app is available on iOS and Android. Go check it out today.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.
What was Bo Diddley like?
Oh, man. There's a cornerstone if there ever was one.
Yeah.
He and I became friends way back in the day. In fact, it was pointed out recently, a friend of mine asked me to autograph a ticket stub from one of the first ZZ Top shows where we were hired to be the backing band for Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry.
Wow.
And from those humble beginnings, that started a friendship that lasted through the years. In fact, it was way back then. This must have been as early as 71, 72. And I was asking Bo about one of those strange Gretsch guitar designs that Gretsch had done for him. And he was really enamored with the fact I knew about him. And I said, a lot of folks are quite familiar with your famous rectangle shaped instrument.
Right.
He said, oh, yeah. He said, that's my calling card. He said, I'm surprised that you know about the other ones. And in unexpected fashion, he said, you know, I've still got it. And he said, I don't play it much. If you'd like it, I'd like you to have it, which I gladly accepted. And yeah. Fast forward 4 decades, we were wrapping up the ZZ Top record entitled Rhythmine. And the engineers, Mr. Joe Hardy and Mr. GLG Main Moon, they said, you know, we've only got a couple more lead tracks to fill out. Do you have a guitar that we haven't used that might give us another different kind of a sound? And I said, well, we could go have a look. And we opened up the doors to the vault, and there in the dark corner, they pointed to a little dusty gray case. And they said, now, what's that one back in the back? It was that very guitar that Bo Diddley had given to me years before. And when the case opened up, their eyes got wide as plates, and they said, gee whiz, this thing is crazy. And it was still in tune. It hadn't been touched in years. And we started using it on gigs. And at this time, this must have been early 90s. And I got a phone call from Mike Lewis, who was the head of Fender Guitars, who had just recently taken on the Gretsch guitar line. They licensed it from Fred Gretsch. And Mike was very curious. He said, I've seen photographs of you playing a rather unusually shaped instrument, but it has it has the Gretsch logo up in the headstock. Mm. And I grinned. I said, oh, yeah. I said, it was a one-off that was made back in the early 60s. It was one of Bo Diddley's. And Mike got on a plane and came out to Los Angeles, and we unveiled it once again, and he lost his mind. He said, this is the coolest thing. He said, do you mind if we have a closer look? And after a thorough inspection, they decided to reintroduce it as a reissue Gretsch guitar, now called the Billy Bow. It was quite exciting. Bo Diddley and I both were being paid to let them dust this thing off.
Oh, that's amazing. I only got to see him once. I think it was probably 2006. I got to see him at the Paramount, and then he passed on maybe 2 years later or something.
You know, he carried the torch on right to the end. He lost no stamina. He was full of energy. It might be worth noting that many of the filmed excursions that took Bo Diddley in front of the camera are still being posted. YouTube carries them. It's really amazing. And some of the great highlights is when Bo Diddley started with his original trio, which was Bo Diddley on guitar, Clifton James on snare drum, and Jerome Green on maracas. That was it. That was made up the band.
Well, I've seen some of his TV appearances, and those are on YouTube, and those are just out of sight. You know, he's like dancing and walking at this, you know, starts up on this mountain, you know, and kind of like walks down the mountain, and he's doing his legs back and forth the whole time. And it's just what a performer.
Yeah, the shimmy and shake that he could pull off while still holding the backbeat is rather amazing. I think you might be referring to the appearance he was included on that thing called the Tammy Show.
Yeah, the Tammy Show, right.
Oh, man. Now, that in itself is an eye-opener. God, the Rolling Stones played, James Brown.
And then he played on Ed Sullivan, and Ed Sullivan, he played the wrong song. Or played an extra song or something, and Ed Sullivan said he would never be on TV again. I guess that didn't last.
Yeah, I think, was it the wrong song? Or I think he extended his stay, and, you know, I mean, he was just rambunctious guy. He was giving it his all.
Well, he had a song called Bo Diddley, and they held up a sign that says Bo Diddley, and so he played that song.
You know?
He's like, he didn't know.
One of my favorite photographs I hold and treasure is a picture of me sitting at the table with Bo Diddley surrounded by a White Castle hamburger and malted milk sacks.
Where was that?
We were somewhere out west, and I remember it was quite cold, and I'd gone to the airport, and he said, White Castle, he said, pull in. I said, you sure? He said, yes, I'm sure, pull in. So that started it.
Another thing I want to ask you about was, you know, just a simple thing like where do songs come from for you? You know, I read a little bit about your last solo record and how that came about. And it sounded like Matt Sorum invited you out to look at a studio, and then you just stayed and made an album. So does that mean the songs were all written there? Did you write them on the spot? Did you bring stuff in?
Yeah, I had worked with the engineer of great talent, Mr. Mike Fiorentino, back in Nashville.
Yeah.
And we had peeled the onion on a couple of starter pieces that were seemingly gaining traction. But once we realized we had arrived in Joshua Tree with nothing more than, you know, just two little tidbits, it was incumbent to light the fuse and let the energies come from the ethos.
Right.
And it just kind of, like so many things, you wait for the moment, and if something shows up, you grab it and see what you can make out of it. But then again, as you know, when we're surrounded with our friends that we enjoy making loud noise with, some of these creative moments, they seem to start erupting. And once the flow starts unfolding, it becomes a real challenge to keep up with it. I tend to just remain vigilant. It's not a chore, it's a challenge.
Right.
And you could be driving down a lonesome highway and something pops into your mind, or you hear, maybe you're listening to a radio broadcast, and whatever that crucial element is that ignites that creative juice, I've learned to carry pencil and paper and pull over on the side and jot it down.
Yeah, stop everything.
Yep.
It's time. Yeah, you got to take advantage of that when it comes to you. Yeah, I look for those. I wait around for them. I try to bring them on.
I do too. You gotta be patient.
Yeah, you never know where. That's the thing with songwriting, is whenever it's time to write a song and you feel that kind of pressure, it's like I try to remember, okay, how did I do this before? And how did I get there? And the thing is, I never knew how I got there, you know? And you never can consciously get back to that place. It will appear to you when it's ready to, you know?
There's a big difference when you want to create something as opposed to when you're expected to create something.
Right, right.
Big difference. When the pressure is on, it seems like the lights tend to go dim. On the other hand, when least expected, you run for the scrap of paper and a pen, and you put that lightning in a bottle. Muddy Waters, you know, we toured with Muddy Waters way back in the early 80s.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And wow. He said, yeah, he said, I was a young man. And he said, seems like a new song would land in my lap almost every day. And now, he said, decades later, he said, I've really got to remain open just in case that same energy comes my way.
Right. Yeah, that's cool to hear. I know you're a fan of the 13th floor elevators. I guess that's something we have in common. When I was 16, I decided I kept hearing about this band that coined the term psychedelic, and the singer was rumored to have gone insane and that the band was broken up because of a drug bust. And, you know, I just kept hearing these little tidbits that got me really interested, but there was nowhere to get those records at the time that I knew of. I had to like dig and dig until I went to Bill's Records in Dallas, and they had a 13th Floor Elevator record that won Bull of the Woods. So that was my first one.
Wow.
And then later I got the Inner Sanctum in Austin had their record, so I would get those. But I don't know, where'd you first hear the Elevators?
There was a club in Houston. It was a converted church called La Maison. And the Elevators, they were just starting to emerge. The first single, You're Gonna Miss Me,
yeah,
that first single really lit the fuse for those guys. They were ready to...
That's a great single.
Oh, yeah, to this day. And then, fortunately, there was a house in Houston, a grand mansion, that unfortunately had been encumbered by the construction of an entry ramp to a new freeway that was being constructed. And Eminent Domain left them in the shadows of this high overpass. And so the family that had taken residence there for years, they decided to abandon ship. They moved out, and the structure was still there. And then a developer came along and turned it in to kind of makeshift apartments. And at that time, following the lead of the 13th Floor Elevators, I founded the group called the Moving Sidewalks. Someone said, yeah, how did that come about? I said, well, we had this fixation with the Elevators. And I said, right. Elevators go up, Moving Sidewalks go forward. I said, let's take... So we wound up occupying different domiciles within the same residence there at the Louisiana House. It got this nickname, the Louisiana House.
Right.
And... earlier, we were speaking about the restaurants of featuring Mexican cuisine that are long by the wayside. On many occasions, we found ourselves enjoying a fine fare with the Elevators at Felix. They had a very affordable combination plate, and it was grand gathering. But yeah, first started hanging out at La Maison just in total awe of what they were delivering. The Elevators were fierce.
Yeah, amazing voice. I've seen video of you guys playing together, but did you ever record anything with them or write anything with them?
Yes. In the not-so-distant past, Darren Hall, who took over management of Rocky, he and I made a rather fast friendship. He had come to understand my undying admiration of Rocky's work from the earliest days up to the more recent, I guess I call it when he crawled from the wreckage and
right.
began making himself known again. I wrote a couple of things. There are a couple of tracks that were done. They're completed songs. The arrangements were together. They're still a bit rough, but I think they could be developed. And out of courtesy to this ongoing friendship, we recently threw our hat in the ring and did a version of I Got Levitation. Mm. And we were out in California, and Rocky came by, and he was beaming. And he said, I thought I was the only one that could get up that high at the end of the song. And I said, well, believe me, it took me several tries to even try and get there.
Right.
Yeah.
But nothing you wrote with him ever came out? Is that what you're saying?
Nothing's been released just yet. You may know the name of Bill Bentley may be recognizable.
Yeah, yeah.
Bill being with Warner Brothers for many, many years. Also a human, right. Native Houstonian. And to this day, a stalwart supporter and follower of everything elevators, I guess you'd say.
Right.
He was behind the launch of the earlier tribute to the elevators. That work, I think it was entitled When the Pyramid Meets the Eye.
I remember that one, yeah. Yeah, you had a song on there. Yeah,
yeah, that was really an interesting combination piece. Yeah, we'll see. Maybe it's time to dust that stuff off. Rocky may be gone, but his legacy, it may be as strong as ever.
Well, I'm good. You got anything else?
Oh, you got me energized and excited. As I mentioned earlier, it looks like we'll be looking forward to being able to hit the road April, no later than May. And in the meantime, if we have our chance to cross paths, we'll have to do maybe a week of just kind of tiptoeing around some of these Mexican restaurants. That we still want.
All right,
still want to haunt.
We'll have to do a tasting. Do a taste test.
I am in, brother.
All right. No, but I hope to get to catch you guys out there on the road this year, and yeah, I hope we do get to cross paths.
Come on out, and let's look forward to. I'm going to use that word again. We got to collide. take it further.
I'm down.
Thanks for listening to the Talkhouse podcast, and thanks so much to Britt Daniel and Billy Gibbons for chatting. If you liked what you heard, please follow Talkhouse on your favorite podcasting platforms and social media channels. This episode was produced by Myron Kaplan, and the Talkhouse theme is composed and performed by The Range. See you next time.